Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. Welcome back to the show, Rick.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Thanks for inviting me on.
Rick, should people be investing in AI heavily right now, or is it still very experimental and iffy?
I think that it's as dumb as a fence post, really. And if you've ever tried to have an intelligent conversation with it, it's so blandly intelligent that it reminds one of Forrest Gump. And for that reason, I'm predicting that it will be an enormous success because, you know, all the boilerplate that AI is capable of doing, including 2/3 of the work done by our vast force of attorneys, can easily be done by an AI bot. You know, the boilerplate these guys churn out is nothing special. And I think that you could even put a bot in the courtroom, and because that bot would have in its memory hole virtually every case settled in the United States and in the history of the Republic, it could provide a very spirited defense or a very aggressive prosecution. You know, it knows everything, whereas a courtroom lawyer knows only some things.
Yes, cross-examination by robot would be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it would definitely back you up to the wall. I have to mention, I'm thankful that AI will never replace me. Every time I reread something I've written, I'm thinking, you know, let an AI bot chew on this.
Now, of course, the workforce right now, we still have just under a million job openings in Canada, just under, 10 million in the U.S. Is AI going to help employers fill those gaps, and will all of a sudden we see mass unemployment?
I think the kind of jobs that are being recruited right now are not the things that AI does. By definition, they're jobs that nobody wants to do, and that means real labor. Of course, AI is not capable of real labor. It's just capable of assembling words. So, no, I don't think AI will put a lot of those people out of work. I guess, somewhat unanticipated thing, the surprise, although not to, let's say, someone writing in Wired magazine, is that it's really a lot of the white-collar jobs that are going to be hit first. And, you know, I mentioned the lawyers, but there will also be accountants. There will be software developers, for sure. And that's probably the one area of AI that we're all praying for, is to get some coders out there who don't give us a lot of garbage software applications such as exist today. So I think the bots can do a lot better at building good programs. AI is already used significantly in software development, but I think it's just going to get better and better. But I was talking to a doctor the other day, a friend of mine, and, you know, he says, he's talking about surgeries being going way beyond the Da Vinci machine, that surgery will be pretty much by the AI numbers at some point. But Da Vinci, which is a machine that performs robotic surgery, which can be trained, is going to be somewhat superseded and somewhat displaced by AI applications of surgical procedures.
Well, there is a shortage of doctors in Canada, but nobody wants to be a family doctor because of the high cost of carrying a practice. So perhaps all those people who wanted to be surgeons are going to have to be GPs after all.
Uh-huh. And you know, when you go to a doctor's office, or over time, you come to realize that a good doctor, forget the Harvard medical plaque hanging on the wall, a good doctor is someone who has listened to his patients and learned over the years. And very few doctors do that. But, of course, AI listens and tunes in on every discussion that's ever happened so that when someone comes into an office, a doctor's office, with something really weird going on, like let's say a subvariant of Ebola that no one's ever seen, the doctor won't even use a line of questioning that considers that as a possibility. But the AI questioning doctor, in quotes, doctor, could sort of drill down on some of these weird symptoms that people report that relatively few doctors can piece together into a coherent diagnosis.
Well, Lyme disease carried by ticks is right across North America, but most cases are undiagnosed or diagnosed so late that the patient is severely ill. I could see where something like that could happen. Also, running just a routine blood test every time you came in and have it scanned by AI, you could probably pick up a lot of stuff before it's a problem.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think AI doctors would do just fine. I think pretty much every white collar job is going to bite the dust except for stock trading newsletter or editors.
So our robot overlords have told us.
And you know, the irony is that it's robots that are essentially controlling trading these
doing
days.
The trading. Yeah, so one robot telling another. And one of our AI experts said, when AI starts training AI, they develop their own language that nobody else can understand.
Uh-huh. You know, we have a lot of AI trading out there. They're called algorithms, and even the very best algorithmic trading system developers, it's hard to stay on top of it. You know, the performance of any trading algorithm will degrade over time, and it's a real trick to sort of tweak it back to its original performance level. So AI is not yet smart enough, really. Well, maybe it is. I'd have to talk to my friend Mike Barna about that. He develops white box trading systems, essentially generating new systems on the fly in real time. So, in other words, it makes trading adjustments as it goes.
There's maybe one thing AI won't understand is emotions, or will they get emotions as well and know it makes people happy and makes them sad, angry, and so on?
Well, the thing is, it can feign emotions, and it can even lie. It's all according to what its developers programmed it to learn, or the way in which it learns. So, you know, the conversations I've had with AI have been pretty bland. It's really non-committal. And I think an unspoken piece of Elon Musk's cautionary word, or maybe even indictment of AI and the full speed ahead approach, is that the development of AI is completely in the hands of woke industry. You know, it's Microsoft, Facebook, Google, all the guys that, at least from my perspective, are the evil guys. That's where AI development, money, research, and progress is coming from. So a number of people have commented in print on the woke tendencies of AI chatbots that we've seen so far.
So there's a prejudice built into the actual programming.
Yeah, and then I guess in some cases, I hardly think it could be inadvertent, but regardless, you know, most of the research and development in the kind of rollout of chatbots, AI-based chatbots, is being financed by guys like Zuckerberg, and who knows, Jack Dorsey, Bill Gates, they're not the guys you want to be in charge of developing a revolutionary new form of intelligence.
We'll have more with Rick Ackerman right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman. Rick, as we head into May, are we going to see a sell in May, go away season this year?
That's pretty reliable, although I've been cautioning the perma bears in my own chat room not to get their hopes too high. I sometimes extrapolate predictions, not from a huge array of technical data, but from one fact that I understand and trust completely. And in this case, I trust completely that that Chipotle stock, which has been buttering the bread of all the chimps who just sort of part money and let it ride, it's been doing quite well for them. And the stock yesterday popped through a crucial, what I call a hidden pivot resistance, at $1,968. And it looks like it's going to close on the weekly bars above that. And that, to me, all but guarantees. I know the regulators don't like me to talk of anything as being 100% certain, but I'm about 99% certain that Chipotle is going to rally from the current 2017 to 2739. So that would be about a 36-37% move. And if it happens, it's inconceivable that the broad averages would be in some sort of bear market. And I did have a very astute trader in my chat room raise the point that, well, you know, Chipotle is moving because it's just a great defensive stock. But that may be so, but it's never going to be so great that it can continue to this amazing target of mine up around 2,700 with the rest of the market in a bear cycle.
Is it about to become the new meme stock? Excuse my voice.
No, because I could take any one of the stocks that provide handsome livings for these chimps, the fund managers who don't really do anything or make decisions. You know, most of their money is made simply by, let's say, staying in Apple. And my chart for Apple is also bullish. Long term, or let's say the long end of the intermediate term, but the move in Chipotle is particularly decisive. It went through that red line, what I call the midpoint hidden pivot resistance, with such force that I can't doubt that it's going all the way to the target, 2739, and you know, it's just going to get there. So whatever bear market people are expecting, it's not going to happen real soon. And let me mention, if Chipotle were to swoon all the way back down to 1600 and the bears were saying, oh, geez, we had it right all along, by my system, that would be a screaming buy. You know, a move down to 1600 would trigger what I call a mechanical buy signal. So what might be getting red at that time as a disaster shaping up in the markets would be a great buying opportunity from my perspective. And I say that as a bear's bear. I don't know of anyone out there who's more bearish on the big picture than I am. It's so bearish that I don't even want to talk about it with you. It's the kind of stuff that you might go to USA Watchdog and read some of the stuff there.
What's going on with gold?
It's in a bear market, but it's there's no real participation. Did I say bear? No, I absolutely meant bull market. It's in a bull market, but there's no participation right now by outsiders. It's all just kind of faithful gold bugs in there. I don't know if I can use the term. Well, they're just screwing the pooch and trading it among themselves. So gold takes these dives, and then rallies to the point of making everyone kind of exuberant, and then it falls dead again. Today, gold broke down beneath a trend line that I've been featuring in my newsletter, and you can only assume that it's a buy because it suggests that the whole world was watching the trend line. So gold is just in a bull market right now that's being driven for the time being by navel gazers.
Is money that would have gone into gold again being siphoned off by Bitcoin and other cryptos?
Oh, I don't know. I guess you could make that case, but I think speculative money is in infinite supply, or some approximation of infinite. So no, I don't think the speculative. And also, you know, when Bitcoin rallies, there's no money behind that rally. A point that I've emphasized in my newsletter many, many times is that Bitcoin rises not because there's demand for it, but because the smart money that's been trapped in Bitcoin at much, much higher prices simply lifts off takes their foot off it. You know, they let it rise when the psychological conditions in the markets are supportive for a rally. You know, Bitcoin used to be leading the market, and in its bad in its wallow, its big move down from late last year, late in 2021, I mean, had the bear market that took it from 70,000 down to 15,000. It certainly wasn't leading the market, but it attracts the kind of players where if they even get a faint whiff of bullishness in the markets, they'll move Bitcoin ahead of it. So I'm about to stop tracking Bitcoin because I've had I don't think I've had more than one or two misses over the last few years on the big swings, and the last three of them I had within less than a half of a percentage point. But even my own subscribers seem to be paying no attention to it. So if my Bitcoin has such limited interest in it right now, and of course the interest by some of the mainstream players, the banks that got involved but never had much skin in the game, they don't really care. They'll just let it drift up if it does, and some of the promoters of Bitcoin will get to unload the stuff. But Bitcoin's currently trading around 30K, but I think they need to get it up to 40,000 or so before the people who have been praying for a rally in Bitcoin and saying, "Oh Lord, please, you know, let me out at 40,000 and I'll, or let me out where I got in and I swear I'll never do it again." But I think if you got Bitcoin at 40,000, all those prayerful Bitcoin losers would turn into, they'd revert to their old selves, which was the greedy Bitcoin player who thinks it's going to 100,000 or 5 million or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Tesla is going to be okay?
Well, when you say okay, guess you're implying relative to whatever multiple its stock price is implying, you know, and I don't know. Tesla's got its hand in so many things that it's hard to completely discount the bullish story. It's a great company. It succeeded in business that nobody wants to do anymore, which is building actual things rather than just shuffling paper or putting things in the cloud. You know, Tesla's a real company with a genius at the helm and a real product. So you can never count them out, but you can reach points where even Tesla's most avid supporters would say, well, it's getting a little pricey here. It's not now. I mean, we had a move from late 2021 from above 400 to a low in this year in January about 100. So it's really been in chops. So I don't think you could say it's overvalued right here.
And I never met a Tesla owner who didn't love the car.
They do love it. My doctor friend, I mentioned him earlier, he had a Tesla Plaid. It's kind of a hot model that, by my experience, it rides like a rock sled. I wasn't prepared when he stomped on it, and I couldn't believe the acceleration. So he loves his Tesla, and even kind of he likes to show off how he can, with his cell phone, park the car while standing outside of the car. But one time it was raining real hard, and we had breakfast, and we went to get back in the car, and his cell phone wouldn't open the door. And that played real havoc, because the nearest dealer was 50 miles away, and there was some question about giving him a loaner and this and that. And he also had another problem at another time when the driver's seatbelt wouldn't retract. And they told him, well, that's because of a chip. It's a digital chip that makes the seatbelt retract, and it's not in stock. We can't get it. So they gave him a whole new car because to some extent, Tesla's at the mercy of chip suppliers. And when you have extreme problems like that, it creates real problems for the bottom line.
Sure. And I live in Vancouver, the Tesla capital of North America. A lot of Teslas on the road here.
And you could say that about South Florida too. I think it's because the car has just sold big in a lot of places. It's just a huge hit, and they've got enough models and enough prices, and they're never just coasting on whatever was hot yesterday. They're always trying to improve the car. And of course, if there's any hope that we're going to get a great power storage solution, I would say Tesla has as good a chance as any company of bringing about that breakthrough.
Fox News lost $700 million in stock value after they let Tucker Carlson go, their top-rated journalist. What's your take on that story?
There's so much bad stuff coming out on that. You know, the Wall Street Journal purported to put out, I guess you'd have to call it the official story, on account of Fox owns the Wall Street Journal. So here they were with the ridiculous think piece yesterday, or an essay or an op-ed piece that said that they yanked him because, they didn't say directly. They avoided saying that one particular reason had caused Carlson's dismissal. But they were saying, but the vulgar letters, they used the word, the vulgar letters that he wrote in office memos and things like that surely contributed to his dismissal. So here's the Wall Street Journal coming up with like a dozen reasons like that, like there were vulgar letters and there was this and that, and it's a lot of crap. The only article I've come across that got it exactly right was written by a fellow named Reckonwald for the Mises Institute. And Reckonwald said that it was all BlackRock's doing. You know, BlackRock has been on a holy war, really, in enforcing the ESG standard, environmentalism, the social consciousness and good governance, and so BlackRock is trying to turn the whole world woke, starting with the corporations that it can force to do what it wants to do. BlackRock has enormous investments in a lot of companies, and it can direct its money in ways that will promote its woke agenda. So BlackRock is the global point guard right now for making woke happen corporately. And guess who? Can you guess what company raised its stake in Fox to 15.1% in February? Take a wild guess.
I think we've been talking about them.
All right. So BlackRock holds not only a big stake in Fox, but a big stake in, I mean, a huge stake in some companies that Carlson has gone after with the meat axe, including Pfizer, Merck, and Johnson & Johnson. And not only that, but Carlson had an interview with Robert Kennedy Jr., who's been making waves and who's known for a statement that the COVID vaccine was absolutely worthless. So, and Carlson has gone directly at BlackRock, saying that its method of using money to transform the corporate political landscape is bypassing the processes of democratic government. So Tucker has execrated BlackRock, so he's really their enemy. So to me, that makes a lot more sense concerning why Fox would fire its biggest cash cow. And there's all this blather about, oh yeah, well, what kind of money did they make with MyPillow ads and things like that? But that's garbage too. You know, you absolutely know that Tucker, as an individual, is the major contributor to Fox's bottom line. And without them, they're gonna sink. And so you think back, and the list sort of grows because they also let Megyn Kelly go, although she got a much better deal. Well, she and Tucker evidently use the same lawyer, so maybe Tucker's severance package will be as juicy as Megyn's was. But they let Bill O'Reilly go too, and he had it in his day the number one show. So the question naturally arises, well, why does Fox keep letting go the best people it's got? And the answer, this is also in the Reckonwald piece from the Mises Institute, he says flat out that that Fox News does not exist to make money. It exists as what they call, what you would call, controlled opposition. So let's say the elites, the powers that be, really want Fox to be there just so that they can make a little noise. But when you make as much noise as Tucker and you've got as much influence as he's gained over the years, there comes a time when you gotta cut your losses, politically speaking, not economically. So if Tucker's firing on top of Megyn's and Bill O'Reilly's doesn't make sense. It makes perfect sense if you accept Reckonwald's statement that Fox isn't what we think it is. It's really just there to be act as controlled opposition, and they just kind of lost control of Tucker.
Yeah, Tucker's reputation was that of not being a management lapdog. He was his own person.
Yeah, and we've seen that, but the Wall Street Journal would suggest that you know, the vulgar slights against his colleagues were like a reason that it was nothing. That was nothing really. And the fact is, I think he got it right. You know, he called someone a lunatic who really is a lunatic, and his opposition to the Ukraine war, which of course grates against BlackRock's mission, was just Tucker's been right about so many things that he really was starting to become dangerous.
Rick, it's always a fascinating chat when you're on the line.
And it's always a pleasure, Jim. Just to tee off a little bit. Someday, let's talk about Nostradamus and what he foresees for everybody, because it's definitely a kind of end-game solution.
Well, in the very end, all the black holes eat all the black holes, and there's nothing left.
I was reading Wired magazine, and they had something very interesting, well beyond my understanding. Wired usually writes at a level where you can kind of grasp what they're talking about. Even when they talk about how difficult it is to create fusion energy, you know, how they take something really tiny and they put it in a solid gold vessel and that's less than the size of a small pearl, and they train 120 super powerful lasers on that thing, and they fuse the nuclei of two atoms, and what escapes is energy. So they're explaining that in a way that you can kind of understand. But when they got into black holes and how they act in ways that, you know, some of the quantum physicists are just kind of, they're just kind of toying with themselves and with us when they describe some of the things that they're associating with the black holes. And I even describe it metaphorically as black holes wind up cannibalizing themselves or some such. Even the headline was too obscure for me to understand. So anyway, we do have our own economic black hole out there that I've talked about, and that's an implosion. That's an implosion of all of the debt instruments that have been spun out, leveraged out to the limit.
Lots of stuff for us to chat about next time.
All right, Jim. We'll just make a note. And on that note, I guess I'll see you in a couple weeks.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks. His website, rickackerman.com. If you have any questions for Rick or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.